Good evening and welcome. It's my distinct honor to welcome you to the 2019 Priestly Celebration. Each year for the last 67 years, we've gathered to present this award to a distinguished scientist in memory of Joseph Priestley. Priestley, the discoverer of oxygen and a close friend of Dickinson's founder, Dr. Benjamin Rush. The presentation of this award demonstrates Dickinson's strong commitment to the sciences as an integral and central focus of the liberal arts, or I should better say, the liberal arts and sciences curriculum. As many of you know, Benjamin Rush was not only a leader in the fight for American independence, but he was also forward-looking in his thoughts on education and in his vision for Dickinson College. As the country's foremost physician, and I should note tonight, America's first chemistry professor, Rush instinctively knew the role that scientific knowledge and discovery would play in shaping the new nation. He therefore expected science to play a central role in Dickinson's curriculum as well. Rush was quite a networker, and he actively sought out other revolutionary thinkers of his day. One of them was Joseph Priestley. Priestley, who was born near Leeds, England in 1733, I'm a historian, so dates are important to me, prepared for a career in the ministry, but developed a deep and active fascination with science. In pursuing this interest, Priestley turned to the investigation of what he described as different types of air. His explorations led to the discovery of 9 gases, including sulfur dioxide, ammonia, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and a gas later named oxygen. I should also note that Priestley invented carbonated beverages in the process of doing this, although he didn't get the patent. That was gotten by Johann Schweppes. Priestley also, by the way, invented the eraser. Priestley's increasingly unorthodox views on theology, coupled with his outspoken opposition to the English slave trade and his support for both the American and French revolutions, forced him to flee England for America in 1794. So Priestley was an immigrant. Actually, he was nearly prosecuted here as dangerous under the Alien and Sedition Acts. Only personal intervention by President John Adams prevented him from being deported as a threat to American security. For our purposes tonight, Priestley formed a close friendship with Benjamin Rush. Although Priestley died only 10 years after arriving in America, his connection to Dickinson College continued when we acquired most of Priestley's scientific equipment, thereby ensuring that Dickinson students would have what were then state-of-the-art scientific instruments with which to work. And you can see this equipment, as many of you know and have already done, including a large burning glass, an air gun, and a reflecting telescope, all in the college's archives. These items literally represent the earliest examples of student-faculty research at Dickinson. As I noted earlier, 67 distinguished scientists, including 15 Nobel laureates, and the only person ever to win a Nobel Prize twice, they have all received this prestigious award. The list of Priestley awardees includes Linus Pauling, recipient of a Nobel in Chemistry and the Nobel Peace Prize. He's the one who won it twice. Nuclear physicist Edward Teller, conservation biologist E.O. Wilson, astrophysicist Carl Sagan, evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould, molecular biologist Francis Crick, and astrophysicist Jocelyn Bell Burnell. Let me now introduce Clark Forum Student Projects co-supervisor Ling Nguyen. She's a Dickinson senior, double majoring in biochemistry and molecular biology and in neuroscience.
Good evening. On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would also like to welcome everyone to tonight's event. At this time, I would like to take a moment to acknowledge that we are gathered here today in a place that lies within the traditional territory of the Susquehannock, the Shawnee, and the Lenape, indigenous peoples who inhabited this land for centuries prior to the arrival of European settlers. This Joseph Priestley Award Celebration Lecture is supported by the College Priestley Fund, is sponsored by the Clark Forum, and is co-sponsored by the Departments of Biology, Chemistry, Earth Sciences, Environmental Studies, Mathematics and Computer Science, Psychology, Physics and Astronomy, and the Churchill Fund. A question and answer session will follow the lecture, so please hold all questions until that time. The Clark Forum welcomes differences of opinion expressed politely, thoughtfully, and succinctly. Disruptive behavior or harassment of the speaker, members of the Dickinson community, or audience members will not be tolerated. Please also silence all your cell phones and electronic devices. In the event of an emergency, handicapped accessible exits are located on the west side of the building. In addition, a book sale and signing will also follow the lecture. And now I would like to welcome Michael Roberts, Associate Professor of Biology, to introduce the Joseph Priestley Award recipient.
Thanks, Lynn. Welcome, everyone. I think we have quite a treat in store for us tonight. I'm glad to see so many people here. It is a rare scientist who pioneers an emergent discipline and remains a leader in that field throughout their career. It is a rare scientist who impacts science policy at the highest levels of government and helps shape the future of scientific inquiry. It is the rare scientist who serves as an inspirational voice for the improvement of science education and increased participation of underrepresented groups in science. And it is the extraordinarily rare scientist who does all of these things during the course of their career. Tonight, we honor an extraordinary scientist, Dr. Joe Handelsman. Dr. Handelsman receives the Priestley Award for her pioneering research in the structure and function of microbial communities and her commitment to advancing science education and the inclusion of all in the scientific endeavor in ways that are equitable and just, and her contributions in shaping national science policy. Dr. Handelsman's accomplishments are too numerous to describe in full in this introduction, so I will mention only some of the highlights. Joe Handelsman earned a Bachelor of Science degree from Cornell University, majoring in agronomy. She earned her PhD in molecular biology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and completed postdoctoral training in the Department of Plant Pathology, also at Wisconsin. Not wanting her to leave, the University of Wisconsin wisely hired her as an assistant professor in the same department, where she quickly rose through the ranks, becoming a full professor just a few years after her tenure decision. Dr. Handelsman was selected as a Howard Hughes Medical Institute professor and became professor and chair of the Department of Bacteriology at the University of Wisconsin before being lured away to Yale University, where she served as a professor in the Department of Molecular, Cellular, and Developmental Biology for 7 years. Dr. Handelsman has held numerous directorships at Wisconsin in a wide range of interests, including the Institute for Pest and Pathogen Management, the Women in Science and Engineering Leadership Institute, which she co-founded, and the Wisconsin Program for Scientific Teaching. And at Yale, she served as the director of the Center of Scientific Teaching. Dr. Handelsman has served as the editor of several high-impact journals and series, ranging from cell biology education to DNA and cell biology, and has published numerous seminal papers in research areas as diverse as the role of the microbiome in infectious disease and gender bias in science. She has served on too many committees to mention and organized workshops on mentoring, scientific teaching, and microbiome research. In 2014, Dr. Handelsman's many talents were again recognized when she was recruited from Yale University. I had written poached, but from Yale University, this time by the White House. She served from 2014 to 2017 as the Associate Director for Science in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Among her many accomplishments working with the Obama administration was the launching of the Precision Medicine Initiative, a bold advance in improving human health. After this period of distinguished public service, Dr. Handelsman has returned to her academic home as the Vilas Research Professor, Professor in the Department of Plant Pathology, and Director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at the University of Wisconsin. Among the many honors and awards Dr. Handelsman has received, I am proud to note that our CVs overlap in one way. We both held an American Cancer Society postdoctoral fellowship. Things deviate a bit from that point on. Dr. Handelsman was selected as a Howard Hughes Medical Institute professor, elected as a fellow of the American Academy of Microbiology, a fellow in the American Association for the Advancement of Science, a fellow in the Association for Women in Science. She received the Presidential Award for Excellence in Science, Mathematics, and Engineering Mentoring. In 2012, she was named one of the 10 people who mattered this year by Nature. In 2019, she was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Along with several teaching awards, honorary degrees, and other honors, Dr. Handelsman has one more important distinction. She is a Dickinson aunt. And we are proud to welcome back her nephew, Josh Handelsman, class of 2012. I like to tell prospective students that at Dickinson, the education they will receive does not prepare them to do one thing. It prepares them to do anything. Joe Handelsman is a living example of someone who has used her talents, training, and drive to accomplish many things, all of significance and all with distinction. It is our honor to present this year's Priestley Award to Dr. Joe Handelsman.
The Priestley Award, which includes a bronze medallion with the likeness of Dr. Priestley, that's what we have here, was first presented, as I mentioned, in 1952 and has been presented each year since to a distinguished scientist honored for discoveries that contribute to the welfare of humankind. Dr. Handelsman, we are pleased to present to you the Dickinson College Priestley Award in recognition of your extraordinary achievements. I would now ask Professor Roberts to read the citation included with the award.
Joe Handelsman receives the Joseph Priestley Award for her pioneering research in the structure and function of microbial communities, including the role they play in infectious disease. Additionally, she is honored for her commitment to improving science education, increasing the participation of women and minorities in science, and shaping science and technology policy.
Congratulations.
Well, this wonderful day at Dickinson and that quite powerful introduction, thank you very much, Mike, and the award itself have left me a little bit speechless for several reasons. One is you couldn't have known this when you selected me for the award, but Joseph Priestley is one of my great heroes of science And there are certain memories that live in your mind, and you know exactly where you were when you learned a certain fact. And I remember in high school reading about his oxygen experiments and the famous Bell jar experiment. And I hear I'm going to get to see his equipment tomorrow. And I remember the awe and excitement I felt about the simplicity and beauty of his experiments and the power that science could have. So it means an enormous amount. The other thing is his first name was Joe, so I kind of like that. And finally, but very, very importantly, the fact that this is from Dickinson means an enormous amount to me because my very dear nephew, Josh Handelsman, was here for 4 years, and I was chagrined and embarrassed and just very upset when he graduated that I missed every visit that I had planned to take to Dickinson. So I never was here with him. And the president was incredibly gracious about inviting Josh to come with me. So we finally get to share the Dickinson experience in a very special way. So I can't thank you enough for this incredible honor. The list of awardees is quite humbling, and I'm not sure I belong in that list, but I am grateful that somebody thought I was, because this is just wonderful. And the likeness to good old Joe is quite remarkable. I've actually been reading a lot about him and looking at a lot of pictures recently, and that's quite remarkable. So thank you again. So to change gears just a bit, I was asked to talk tonight about anything I wanted, but including some of my own research. So that's kind of a tall order because I have a lot of interests, as you heard. And so what I decided to talk about are my favorite organisms, the microbes of the world, and talk about one of my complaints about microbial history, and that is that the microbes have a terrible name, and talk a little bit about why. But then talk about the evolution of our thinking about microorganisms, how we understand them to play a role in the world around us today, and particularly how they run our planet. And so often when people hear about microbiome research or think about microorganisms, they think about their relationship to people in a very intimate way, infectious disease. But in fact, the microbiomes of the world are far more powerful in soil, in water, in air, in just about every environment on Earth, in terms of shaping our destiny. And so I'd like to talk about that. And then how I came to study the soil microbiome and the system that we've developed. And it's the beginning of a story that I started in many ways 34 years ago, but in other ways, really when I left the White House, I decided to try something new. So I'm not going to be able to give you a ton of answers, but hopefully I'll tell you how we're approaching some of these questions. So the first question, because I know that we're not all microbiologists here, much to my chagrin, is what are microbes? And so when we use the word microbe or microorganism, we're usually referring to a collection of organisms that may be either viruses or some of the most beautiful ones in my mind are the protists. These are usually unicellular organisms. Some of which can move and are more like little animals. Others are sessile and more like little plants. And then also multicellular but still microscopic worms known as nematodes. But the organisms I'm going to talk about tonight are largely in the prokaryotic world. These are the closest to my heart. And these are the bacteria, which I'm sure you've all heard of, and the other group of prokaryotes, which is a little bit less well-known, and that's the archaea. And the archaea and the bacteria branched. They separated evolutionarily a long time ago. And they look similar in that they form single cells. They don't have nuclei, which is why they're both prokaryotes. But they have some remarkably different physiological and biochemical characteristics and abilities. And so I'll touch on a couple of those. So the history of microbiology, if you look at everything from the Bible and ancient times to more recently, has really been filled with the plagues and diseases that we associate with microorganisms. And so everything from literature, like Camus' description of the plague, Bruegel's paintings, and many other representations in artistic history have portrayed microbes as these devastating features of human life. The microbes were first discovered as microbes in around the 1670s by Leeuwenhoek, who was a draper in Delft in the Netherlands, and ground glass in ways that people have not quite matched even today. He was such a sophisticated grinder of lenses. And so he was able to create lenses that enabled him to see microbes, and he was the first to ever describe microbes. And he actually had enormous affection for his organisms, and I don't know if he ever associated them with disease, but certainly after that, they became very much associated with the spread of disease. One of the most devastating diseases that gave microbes a very bad name in the 19th century was the Irish potato famine. This is caused by an oomycete that I'll show you a picture of later. This is a protist. Not a prokaryote, not a bacterium, and it caused one of the most devastating famines in the history of humankind and totally changed the face of Ireland. This is a statue in Dublin, and you can see it's right in the middle of Dublin, and you can see the relationship of people walking down the street in Dublin to this statue, which represents people starving during the Irish potato famine. It shaped the United States by generating an enormous immigration of Irish people to the United States. It changed laws across England and changed the relationship of the United States with the UK and had many, many other impacts. But it also fostered an interest in microorganisms that was really unprecedented because the power of what one microorganism could do to the human species was demonstrated so clearly. In the 1870s, someone named Robert Koch developed a marvelous way of growing microorganisms, and those became what we now know of as petri dishes. He started actually with a half of a potato, which was also circular, and gave him a nice flat surface. And he found that the microbes would land just from the air on the surface of the potato, and he would get these beautiful isolated colonies, and he could develop what was known as a pure culture from them. And this is an example of a pure culture. Before this, microbes were studied only in mixtures. It was very difficult to get them isolated away from other microbes. And so Koch made a very enormous advance in microbiology by developing the concept of the pure culture. But we learned later, for probably about 130 years, this was the backbone of microbiology. Most studies were done using cultured organisms as the basis. But we learned that most organisms, microorganisms, in fact, don't grow under standard conditions. We give them food in the lab and try to isolate them away from their friends, and often they don't grow. And we began in the late 20th century to understand the depth of that observation and the power of that observation, that in fact, the organisms that do grow under these laboratory conditions are the small minority. In soil, for example, it's probably about 1% or 0.1% of the bacteria that live in the soil that will grow on petri dishes. In the ocean, it's much, much smaller, probably 0.01% of the organisms will grow in culture. And so in the late 20th century, we began to develop the DNA-based methods that allowed us to see these organisms and not see them physically, but see their signatures, their DNA signatures that told us not exactly who they were necessarily, but who they were related to by phylogenetic techniques. And so this was the revolution in microbiology. When I graduated from graduate school, I remember some of my colleagues in graduate school kind of looking at me pityingly because they were all going off to study things like nematodes, little worms, or fruit flies, or mice, and I was staying in bacteria because I just loved these creatures. And they thought, no, there's nothing left to learn. Why are you staying in bacteria? And for those of you who know what lambdaphage is, some of them would say, hey, since lambda, because that's been a completely mapped genome and a very well-understood organism, they said, since lambda, you know, it's all done. It was just for a few years that I lived with that misconception. Within about 10 years, there was a revolution underway. We now know that not only are we not done, but we haven't even begun to understand the microbes. Because all of our knowledge comes from this kind of system, a petri dish in the laboratory of one organism growing by itself. Most microbes don't live on their own. So when we try to grow them in culture, it may be that they need one of their friends to provide nutrients or to remove toxic waste. They live in communities just like we do. And just like we assign all the different functions in communities, so do the microbes. And so their dependency on other microbes has been the ignored fact in microbiology for well over 100 years. And it's now beginning to change. So this is one of the most exciting times, in my opinion, in the history of science. And the science that is moving rapidly and driving much other knowledge throughout the world, not just in biology, is microbiology. What we found was that not only are the organisms that don't grow in culture abundant, but they're also diverse. And we realized that what we know from these cultured organisms is actually pretty minimal because the physiologic and biochemical diversity of all these other organisms is so tremendous. So we have a few representatives that live in the lab that we've studied very well. We know an awful lot about them. Some of what we know about them will apply to all of life. Some will apply to all microbes. And some will apply only to their nearest relatives. And the question is, how do we begin to study this diversity of the rest of them? The molecular or DNA-based analysis told us that in fact most of the world, most of the biological world, is microbial. So if you look at the tree of life, and this separates things based on how long they took to develop in evolutionary time and what they're related to based on molecular markers, you realize that one group is the bacteria, the other is the archaea, those are our prokaryotes, and then the other is the eukaryotes. And that includes organisms like animals and fungi and plants. This is what we think of when we think of biology. Often we think of the organisms we can see, ones like us. Those are the tiny minority in biology. Look at even in the eukaryotes, how almost all of the groups that branch in this tree, and particularly the older ones, are all microorganisms. Microscopic organisms that just happen to be eukaryotes. And then the other two branches are prokaryotes, non-nucleated, very, very old organisms. But if you look at the ciliates and the flagellates and the trichomonids, these are very diverse organisms, as different from each other as we are from fungi, which is pretty different, I think. And these organisms have enormously diverse lifestyles, ways of making a living, and ways of affecting the world around them. So we began to realize that we have to look at the microbial world if we're ever going to understand how the Earth actually works. Historically, we've always known, since a long time ago in biology, that the key events were microbiological. So does anyone have a guess about what the biggest event in Earth's history was?
Oxygen.
And who formed our oxygen? The microorganisms, of course. So if you look at the evolution of the diversity of life, you see that some pretty important events happened. So this curve shows the buildup of oxygen in the environment. And so about 3 billion years ago, 3.5 billion years ago, cyanobacteria or photosynthetic bacteria began to produce oxygen. Before that, there wasn't very much oxygen in the environment. It was pretty much anaerobic. As that oxygen started to accumulate, that also formed the stratospheric ozone layer. That was one of the most important elements in our environment because it allowed land plants to develop. So that was when organisms moved from the ocean onto land. And now for the first time, because the stratosphere contained the ozone that filtered out ultraviolet radiation, now organisms were allowed to live on land without being destroyed by UV light. And then land animals progressed, and then we got the diversity, the explosion of diversity that resulted from those events. So it was these very early microorganisms that were able to take sunlight and convert the energy to chemical energy and produce oxygen from it that gave us the oxygenated environment, which ultimately led to the buildup of ozone as well as oxygen. So we can thank the microbes for the ozone layer, for the buildup of oxygen. We can also thank them for their role in controlling our carbon dioxide levels. So there's, of course, a lot of interest these days in what generates the carbon dioxide in our atmosphere and what takes that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And it turns out that even though people like to give plants all the credit, most of that carbon dioxide fixation that results from photosynthesis is actually done by microorganisms. So everyone will talk about the rainforests, which are, of course, critically important, and all the plants on Earth. But it turns out that the microbes of the ocean are critical for carbon dioxide fixation and do at least half of it. And then microbes that I'll be talking about in a different environment, that of the soil, are critical for storing carbon on Earth. So they not only fix the carbon, but then the soil, which is where I'd like to turn now, is the place where we store most of our carbon. So in all the discussions about carbon tax and carbon credits and carbon balance and climate change and greenhouse gases, I have never heard it said, except by me, and I sound like a broken record to the people who've heard me say this, that in fact the soil carries three times as much carbon in a fixed environment than all the plant life on Earth, three times as much and twice as much carbon as is in our atmosphere. So if you really want to affect the carbon in the atmosphere, which is CO2 and methane and other greenhouse gases that are so important to the warming of our planet, why not go for the biggest sink rather than a less big sink? I think there's a lot more to gain from looking at the soil. So that's why I want to talk to you about soil tonight. Soil has been respected throughout history by just about every religion that I've been able to find. My favorite here is Eartha, who is a Germanic goddess. But just about every Eastern and Western religion had a goddess, and it was usually a goddess, female, that represented soil. And usually that goddess was the highest ranking goddess in those religions. For a long time, I couldn't find examples in the Judeo-Christian tradition. I could only find it in these older religions. And then I read a book one day, not the Bible, but another one, that quoted this piece from the Bible. And it says, "The Lord hath created medicines out of the earth, and he," that's typo, it should be she, "that is wise will not abhor them." And I think this was Ecclesiastes, I think that was talking about penicillin, because in fact our antibiotics, like penicillin and many others, come from earth, come from the soil, come from bacteria that live in soil or fungi that live in the soil. So that was the first indication to me that, in fact, yes, it really did permeate every religion. And I mentioned this to my father once, and he looked at me and said, "But don't you know what Adam means?" I said, "Well, no, actually. My Hebrew's not that good." It turns out that Adam in Hebrew means earth or soil. So, in fact, the origins of the human species, according to Judeo-Christian myth, is in fact from soil. So every religion has respected soil deeply, in fact, revered soil. But in the current day, that's not true. We actually kind of abuse our soil. So this is a familiar sight to those who live in farm country. This is a terrible sight to see, ever. Soil should never be plowed, and these rows and ridges are evidence of plowing. Even though Thomas Jefferson, who was a very good friend of Priestley, I should say, and admired him greatly, Thomas Jefferson said once that the greatest invention in human history was the moldboard plow. Jefferson was right about a lot of things. He wasn't right about that. The moldboard plow has been devastating to many civilizations, and this is an image that I hope everyone will come to abhor from now on. We dig our soil. We expose it to air, which it may not be used to. We build piles of it and leave them there to dry out, to get oxygenated, to do all sorts of things that kills the microbes that live in them. And so we abuse our soil in farming, but then in all of our other activities, building houses and mining and everything else that involves the earth. So not only don't we revere soil, like most societies have throughout history, but we actively abuse it. And despite the fact that many societies have revered soil, many of them have inadvertently destroyed it and destroyed their civilizations in the process. Now we know we're destroying our soil, and we don't revere it, and we will probably destroy our own civilization in the process. Soil comes in many different colors and shapes and textures. These are just a few examples of the beautiful variety of soils. It's a wonderful, really fascinating mixture, one of the most complex environments on Earth that involves a mixture of weathered rock, which means rock that's been exposed to the elements for a very long time, pulverized various kinds of rock and other geologic material, which becomes eventually sand, silt, and clay, and that's what these particles are here, sand being the largest sized particles, silt being mid-sized, and clay being the smallest. And then, of course, what gives soil its lifeblood is literally the living and decomposing plants, animals, and microbes that live in it. So soil is a constantly changing, very biological, but also very physical and chemical environment. The microbes that dominate in soil are diverse. Some of them can be cultured. Many of them cannot. And we know that a teaspoon of soil or a gram of soil contains about 1 billion living cells of bacteria. That includes many thousands of different species. So it's an overwhelming diversity. It's the most diverse environment on Earth. So again, we hear about other environments that are marvelous, like the rainforest, as being so diverse. In fact, a temperate soil is more diverse than all of the above-ground macroscopic organisms in a rainforest. So every time that we're exterminating our soil, we're also probably exterminating species and not knowing it. We also know there are fungi and protists and nematodes and viruses. Again, I'm going to focus on bacteria, but we know that they also give the tremendous variety of behaviors and propensities of soil. But not all soil is kept healthy by all those organisms. This is an example of a severe drought that has happened in what was a non-desert environment that became a desert. These are examples of deeply eroded hillsides that have been destroyed in terms of their soil and life-giving capacity because they're basically down to rock, bedrock and subsoil. And then again, we see the deeply plowed soil that has been turned over, exposed to the environment, and whose architecture the clods and structure of soil has been destroyed, which is one of the most devastating things you can do to soil. After the Dust Bowl, which was the loss of soil in a good portion of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt signed legislation for the Soil Conservation Act, and that started the Soil Conservation Service in this country, which eventually changed its name but still exists today. And when Roosevelt was signing this and then writing to governors saying, you really have to ratify this legislation, this is very important, he made the most beautiful statement that is often quoted, that the nation that destroys its soils destroys itself. And this statement has become even more true in the last 80 years since the legislation was passed. And in fact, we now have more and more evidence that this is true throughout history. There's evidence that the Roman Empire was destroyed in part by the destruction of the soils on the hillsides outside of Rome, where the plowing went up and down the hills instead of across the hills, and the result was the loss of soil from the hillsides, and plants could no longer be grown. Easter Island went from a population of 14,000 down to about 2,000 as a result of destruction of the soil. All the soil went into the ocean. And to this day, even though that happened a very long time ago, to this day, Easter Island has not recovered. The population is still around 4,000. So what happened after Roosevelt signed the Soil Conservation Act? Well, there were some efforts to conserve soil or protect it. We signed other legislation in the 80s that really had a big effect. And you can see here we're looking at erosion of cropland by year across the U.S. in billions of tons of soil. And you can see that here it was at about 3 billion tons of soil per year in 1982. And it kind of steadily went down. And there was legislation in 82 and then again in 85 that helped to conserve soil. And then the Farm Bill, two successive Farm Bills, came in and gutted that legislation and prevented the holding of farmers accountable for how they treated their soil. So today, a farmer can self-certify and say, I'm practicing soil conservation, and no one checks. So you can imagine how often they shave corners and they don't report exactly what they're doing because no one comes out to their farms to check because the Farm Bill gutted the ability of the USDA to check. And so you can see that after a few years after that Farm Bill, we no longer are seeing that nice steady decrease in erosion. It's leveling off, and there's some evidence that more recently it has started to rise again. So this is serious. We don't have unlimited amounts of soil. On top of it, one of the drivers of soil erosion is weather, particularly heavy precipitation. And anyone who's been in the Midwest in the last few years can attest to the enormous storms that have suddenly started to plague the Midwest every single year. They used to be these somewhat exceptional events in history. Now they come many times a season. And the National Weather Service has tracked this and said, how many every year, how many heavy precipitation events are there? And you can see that they did an average for the 1900s, from 1900 to 1950. You can see every year kind of clusters around some mean. But since the 1950s, there's been a steady and continual rise in the frequency of these violent rain events. And there isn't a single year that is equivalent to the pre-1950s years, and it's getting worse. Predictions are that this will continue to rise as climate change progresses, and we will develop more and more aggressive storms. So whatever we're doing in terms of erosion or seeing in terms of erosion today is just going to increase enormously because the velocity of raindrops that hit the soil particles is part of the equation of what makes soil erode. So the higher velocity raindrops will destroy soil structure more readily, and then that soil is more likely to wash away. So when I was in the White House, my group did some projections, and we asked, let's just assume that your average, for example, Iowa farm field has about 1,000 tons of topsoil per acre. So we're starting here. I've now updated it to 2020. So let's say in 2020, we have 1,000 tons per acre on your average field. If we were eroding at the national average, which USDA says is about slightly under 5 tons per acre per year, we would see soil amounts eroding or reducing like that. This accounts for production of soil, which happens at about 0.5 tons per acre. Many people would argue much less, but we'll give it the generous side of half a ton per acre. And so the composite amount of soil left is mapped here. And you can see that we would be at about half loss by about 2120, so about 100 years. That's enough to deeply affect our yields. So when you start getting 40% of the soil eroded or more, you begin to see really big yield effects. So even if we stuck with that average of 5 tons per acre per year, we would see an inability to keep up with the population and grow enough crops to feed people by early in the 22nd century. But the story gets much worse than that. The average of 5 tons per acre per year is across the entire country, the entire United States. In fact, if you go into Iowa and you measure erosion, you find that there are areas eroding at much higher rates, 10 tons per acre per year, sometimes 50 tons per acre per year, and in some areas, 100 tons per acre per year. In 2012, there was one storm that eroded 50 tons per acre in one afternoon. That's the amount of soil that would take hundreds and hundreds of years to form. So that's the kind of violent rainstorms that we're having and the kind of effect they could have. So our projections, if we were eroding, say, at 25 tons per acre, 50 tons per acre, and 100 tons per acre, show a much more rapid loss of soil down to subsoil or bedrock. So even by 2030, some of these areas will be completely out of soil. And in fact, some of them are now. There are pictures of flying over Iowa where you can see the exposed subsoil sticking through. There's no topsoil left. And so some of those areas have already been subjected to this kind of loss. But if you look at these rates, there are many other areas that will be subjected to this kind of loss. In Iowa, there are, and this is just one example, there were 138,000 acres that were eroding at the 25 tons per acre per year in a recent year. So this is an enormous amount of land that is eroding far faster than what the USDA argues is the average. And that's one of the problems, is that the average doesn't take into account this enormous variation between different areas. If this land has a greater slope, it will erode more quickly. If it's subject to more rainstorms, it will erode more quickly. If it's been plowed, it will erode much more quickly. And so this kind of variation to these very high levels of erosion has to be taken into account. And given the increase in heavy precipitation, there's no question that we will be increasing pretty rapidly beyond the 5 tons per acre per year. So when I was in the White House, I commissioned a report from the 15 federal agencies that all expressed interest in soil, and we asked them, what would you do to preserve our soil? It turned out that every major country, a developed country, and developing countries had plans for their soil. They had strategic plans for the country. The United States didn't have one. I thought that was kind of appalling. So we looked at Brazil's plan, which was pretty good, a nice strategic plan on how to preserve their soil. We asked this group to come up with a framework for such a plan for us. And some of the key findings I'll just mention here were that they felt we need much more interdisciplinary research and education about soil. We need to educate more soil scientists, and we need to educate the public about soil. We need more research that draws on some of the very powerful technologies we have today, from remote sensing to genomics to all sorts of other technologies that could be informing soil science but aren't actually being brought to bear sufficiently. One of the exciting advances is the power of computation and sophisticated data analysis, which when you're dealing with the landscape level analyses that many soil scientists want to do estimates of what's going to happen to our soil, is absolutely critical. And the modeling that can be done today is unlike any others before us, and the machine learning that's being applied to soil science is really unprecedented. And then they made a strong point that we need to expand the use of sustainable agriculture practices. This means not plowing. This means drilling seed into the soil, using last year's stubble to hold the soil down, not digging the soil up and turning it over. And there are several other practices that are important. That brings up for me one of the more emotional aspects of soil. The Midwest of the United States has been gifted with one of the most unique resources in the world. It's called a mollisol. So soils, just like animals and biological features of the world, are divided into different groups by a taxonomic process. Same with soils. We have a whole taxonomy of soils. The mollisol is one of the most almost magical creations by soil. And, of course, mostly it's created by plants and microbes. There's nothing magic about it. But what's remarkable is these incredibly deep, dark, rich soils that are typical of our Midwestern United States only occur in four places in the world. Four places. We have an enormous tract in the Midwest of the U.S. The Ukraine is known for its very dark black soil, and some arguments are that that's been why it's been such of such interest to everyone from the United States to Germany to Russia. Northeast China has one area of mollisols, and there's a small region in Argentina. So we have this gift of the most fertile type of land there is in the world, and most countries don't have such a gift. And even countries that do have much smaller segments of their land in this kind of gift. And we are squandering it. We are destroying it through erosion based on the practices that we use. So we can stop doing those practices. But my group is interested in what can we do to build those mollisols back. So that means looking at how they were built in the first place. And we know that it was the great prairies of the Midwest that generated the mollisols. And prairie plants are known for their extremely deep, strong root systems that are very aggressive. They spread throughout the soil, and they spread very deep. There are records of hundreds of feet deep tap roots of some of these plants. The beauty of them is that their whole goal in life is to put their storage into the ground, into their roots, because they want to survive for next year. These are perennial plants. Crops, on the other hand, for the most part, with some exceptions, are usually bred, and we have changed them dramatically from their wild state, but they've been bred to put all their energy above ground. So a corn plant, I offended one of my agronomy colleagues recently, so I'm now known as the stupid plant person, because I called a corn plant a stupid plant. But it really is. If you were going to design a plant that was bad for the world, it would be a corn plant. And the Midwest is covered with them. The corn plant has these pathetic little roots, little strands of roots that can barely hold the corn plant up. But the point of the breeding for decades and decades of corn breeding has been you get as much yield in that ear as possible. And one of the ways to get that yield is to sacrifice the roots. So corn just sucks the life out of soil. It takes nutrients out and it puts nothing back. So we know that replacing corn with beautiful, deep-rooted prairie plants can enrich the soil in in actually quite remarkable ways. So there's this study in Iowa where they developed the STRIPS program, where they teach farmers to replace just 10% of their corn plants with very strategically placed prairie plants, just 10%. And by putting those strips in, they can take erosion down to 5% of what it was. So they're getting rid of 95% of the erosion by taking just 10% of their corn out of production. And that pays for itself over 3 or 4 years because the prairie plants enrich the soil so much that then they can reduce their fertilizers. So it sounds like a great deal, right? So when I was in the White House, I looked into, why doesn't everyone do this? Well, it turns out, once you say it, it's kind of obvious. If a farmer says, I'm going to plant 10% less corn this year, their crop insurance goes down by 10%. Farming is at such a tiny, life-threatening margin. I mean, farmers are always working at the edge of viability, that if they get 10% less crop insurance, that's disastrous for many farmers. They can't take that risk. So our crop insurance system is totally messed up. So ask me why I didn't fix it. I'll tell you that story too. I wish I could have. So until we fix very systemic problems like that, I don't think we're going to get widespread incorporation of practices like STRIPS. So despite all of the benefits that we know of practices like this, we still have a problem getting them incorporated into our stupid plant systems like the corn plant. So my group is asking, okay, let's assume we're still going to be planting corn and soybeans, which are difficult crops, to say the least, for the life of the soil. What can we do to enrich the soil and to make those crops better for the soil environment? And that means looking at the carbon cycle. We know that the sun drives photosynthesis. Plants then take up carbon dioxide, and they use the energy of the sun to fix carbon into sugars. They transport those sugar molecules down to their roots, and as much as a third to a half of the carbon that a plant will fix never even stays in the plant. It goes out into the environment around the roots called the rhizosphere, which tells you something very important. What's happening in the rhizosphere? Well, bacteria are eating that carbon. Well, that says that plants haven't evolved in natural conditions to do wasteful things. They're not wasting their carbon. They are feeding their microbes. And you have to imagine that this has been selected over many, many generations of plants. So that tells you something about the importance of the rhizosphere to begin with. So we know that the roots release carbon, and this can be an enormous amount of carbon, and is important for the stability and health of soil. So the microbes eat that carbon, and then they start producing, among other many, many other things, these long, sticky polysaccharides. Polysaccharides stick soil particles together. They act like the glue of soil, and they give soil its architecture or its structure. So this is the fact that my group thinks we may be able to use. We could build soil health, build soil structure by boosting the polysaccharide production by soil microbes. But to do that, we need to manipulate those organisms in the microbial community. And it turns out that that's really tough. We've known for a long time that bacteria do this sticking together. And you've probably seen this if you've ever looked at beach sand. When the water recedes on a beach, you can often see these kind of crusts forming. You can almost pick up a piece of the sand. That's polysaccharides from the bacteria that are sticking those sand particles together. We've known that this is, and these are bacteria with their strands of polysaccharide. We've known that this is a process that holds soil together. But the challenge is not understanding that process. It's understanding how we can change the microbiome or the microbial community of the soil in a way that will generate more polysaccharide production and ultimately less erosion. We've known for well over 100 years that microbiomes are really hard to change. And one of the early experiments, and I'm sure there were many others, but this one was documented, was by Ilya Metchnikoff, who was a great microbiologist who did most of his work in France in the early 20th century. And he was hell-bent on changing his own microbiome. So he started eating vast amounts of yogurt. He said that he ate liters and liters of yogurt per day. And he found that the live cultures from the yogurt, lactobacillus, were present in his gut microbiome. But as soon as he stopped eating the yogurt, by the next day, he could no longer find the lactobacillus in his microbial community. And this is just one example. We have many, many examples of trying to change microbiomes, trying to introduce new organisms into microbiomes, and we don't have a clue how to do it. We don't understand how these communities function. So, for example, the human microbiome, just to give you a magnitude of the complexity, is 100 to 1,000 times more complex genetically than the human genome, which is pretty complex. The soil is 10 to 100 times more complex than that, with more than 4,000 species. We don't even know how many species are in soil because there are so many that we haven't characterized yet. The second part of this, besides this enormous complexity that is hard to study, is that we don't have any governing principles. We don't have the rules of microbiology worked out in microbial communities. Most, as I was saying before, of our microbiology has been in pure culture, single organisms. And so you start putting organisms together, and maybe we have some information about two different species being together, but you get beyond that, and there's very little known about what makes a community robust or stable. What are the genes that are involved in making a community resist invasion? Or what makes an organism able to invade a stable community. So my lab started thinking about this when I got out of the White House. I said, I'm going to do a project that I've never done before, but I have wanted to since graduate school. And that was to develop a model community, a model microbial system that we could use to understand the rules of communities, where the community is the unit of genetic analysis rather than the organism. And that was based on many, many years of model systems. We know that mice and fruit flies and E. coli and worms and other organisms have boosted our knowledge enormously in areas like developmental biology, cell biology, biochemistry, genetics. But we have nothing like that for microbial communities. And for a long time, the microbiology community said, you can't possibly create anything in the lab that will tell you about the real community in the real world. That could have been said. In fact, you go back to the old literature, and it was said about E. coli and white mice. People would say, well, you know, those are so different from all these other organisms, they won't represent biology. Well, in fact, they've represented biology extraordinarily well. And certainly E. coli doesn't tell us about all the microbes of the world, but it does tell us an awful lot about basic biological functions. And so I decided we needed the same thing for a microbial community. The challenge was, how could you find a community that would be simple but still relevant to natural systems? And so I'd like to introduce you to THOR, which is our microbial community, and I'll tell you how it got its name. It's based on about three decades of work in my lab that started with a quest to suppress plant disease using microbes instead of chemical pesticides. So I promised I would show you Phytophthora, the causal agent of the Irish potato famine. That's it here. It's a beautiful organism. But it's also violently destructive against many, many plants. We studied it on alfalfa. This is what it does to alfalfa plants, stunting them, girdling them, preventing them from developing. But we found an organism that when the alfalfa plants were treated with it, they were completely protected in the laboratory and didn't get the disease caused by Phytophthora. That organism was one of 1,000 organisms that we tested. It came from an alfalfa root in Arlington, Wisconsin. It's a healthy alfalfa root. It forms these lovely spores. It's very heat stable and desiccation resistant, so it's fabulous for manipulating as an eventual product. It also has the extraordinary ability to produce what looks like a very small and ordinary molecule, but is in fact a very unusual antibiotic that is synthesized in an unprecedented way. And the last 20 years have revealed all sorts of things about antibiotic synthesis that we didn't know anything about because of the study of this little molecule that we named Zwittermycin. So there were a lot of extraordinary things about Bacillus cereus. But then I have this graduate student who told me this story. This is one of my very first graduate students. He would isolate bacteria from roots, and he was studying Bacillus cereus on roots. So he would pick the Bacillus cereus colonies on media and then streak them out for single colonies to try to get pure cultures. And he would take those pure cultures, and he would patch them onto plates in a grid like this and put them in the refrigerator. When he came back 3 weeks later, he would find that some of them had this yellow color and a kind of slimy consistency that was very different from Bacillus. And so he would test them, and he found, in fact, they had another organism that was very often a thing called Cytophaga. So he told me about this, and I said, oh, well, you know, in my arrogant assistant professor mode, I know none of the assistant professors here have this problem. I said, oh, well, you know, you're a plant pathology student, you're not a microbiologist, so maybe you just don't know how to keep a pure culture. Well, after he told me this several times, and I kind of rolled my eyes, and then the next student told me this. Finally, after years, I let one of my students study what were by then being called the hitchhikers. Now it turns out this is probably a general phenomenon, and everyone in microbiology that I've talked to who's found something like this says they're afraid to talk about it in public, as was I, because people would say, you're a bad microbiologist, you just have contaminants, just like I said. But it turns out that now I've heard of 3 different organisms that consistently carry hitchhikers, particularly when they're put in the fridge or the freezer. Why that's a factor, we don't know. So Thor is based on the words, the hitchhikers of the rhizosphere. We decided we've studied Bacillus cereus, we have its genome sequenced, we can do genetics, we have all this information about its biochemistry. We've been studying it for so long. Make that part of our model community. And then it very conveniently carries these interesting organisms in from the field. By the way, this is an interesting phenomenon because it only happens on Bacillus cereus colonies from roots, and we've never found it happen from soil. And that becomes interesting later in the story, which is now. When you grow one of the major hitchhikers, which is Flavobacterium johnsonii, I'll just call it Flavobacterium, when you grow it in media, it grows quite fine. So this is starting inoculum in blue, and then the final after 3 days in pure culture in red. And when you add Bacillus cereus to it, there's no particular effect on growth. But it turns out that despite the fact that this organism came from a root environment, it is unable to grow in exudate from soybean roots or alfalfa. So again, starting inoculum 3 days later, you see there's no change. It's not growing. But we add Bacillus cereus, and it grows quite happily, as well as it does in a culture where it's given a good carbon source and synthetic media. It's not quite as it's actually even more dramatic on alfalfa because the populations have a tendency to drop in 3 days, and then you can get them to partially recover in alfalfa root exudate by adding Bacillus. So we started realizing that Bacillus was facilitating growth by Flavobacterium, and we ultimately found that that was because Bacillus sloughs off bits of its cell wall, and Flavobacterium uses those bits as food. And so it's then able to grow in other environments. So maybe that's why we find the Flavobacteria hanging along as hitchhikers on the root and not in the soil, because it's the root that deprives them of a good carbon source. They need Bacillus. And we recently found a very exotic behavior. This is a completely new form of bacterial movement. Flavobacterium forms what we're calling zorbs. So normally Flavobacterium is what we call a gliding bacterium. It slides along a surface by a not too well understood but partially understood mechanism that's different from swimming bacteria. But we found that in a particular set of conditions that I won't go into, it goes from this gliding mode to a pinwheeling movement, which has been described by others. But then we found that it aggregates in a biofilm, which is an aggregate of bacteria held together by polysaccharides. And that biofilm then moves. And the rate of movement is quite remarkable. It's about a micron per minute, which is really fast for bacteria. And biofilms are always thought as sessile. We think of them as anchored to a surface. This is the first example of a mobile biofilm. And then eventually the zorbs will disaggregate and stop moving. We found that when you put Bacillus cereus together with Flavobacterium, we get an interesting response. So what you're seeing here is under the microscope, there's Flavobacterium that's labeled in reddish-orange, and then there's Bacillus cereus, which is in green. And you can start, if you're close enough, beginning to see aggregates of Flavobacterium forming. It forms the zorbs. You can see them under the microscope. And soon after you see the zorbs form, you'll start seeing enough of the bacteria in there for it to turn orange or red. And then eventually, look for the green, start seeing the Bacillus cereus drilling into the zorb and forming those green blobs inside. We can't find any evidence that something like this has ever been seen before. So we think this is a really exciting, not only new form of motility for bacteria, but a co-migration that they do together. The significance of it, we don't know, but we know that it means that they have a pretty intimate relationship. So we wanted a third member for our model community. We now had the first hitchhiker and Bacillus. So we looked for another hitchhiker. We found one that was really exotic. This one also comes in as a hitchhiker on Bacillus cereus, but it has this remarkable ability of inhibiting Flavobacterium growth, and it only inhibits growth of members of the phylum that Flavobacterium is in. It's called the Bacteroidetes. There are no known antibiotics, until we published this one, that have that kind of specificity for the Bacteroidetes. So that was kind of cool. So we looked at what these antibiotics were. Turned out there's a collection of them, Coriancin, A, B, C, and D. Is similar, it's related, but it doesn't seem to have activity. A, B, and C have beautiful activity against Flavobacterium. And they're unlike known antibiotics, but they are related to some toxins from plants. And the most notable one is the toxin from the hemlock. That is what Socrates used to commit suicide. And so they're pretty nasty molecules, but they had never been reported in bacteria and never with these particular structures and never as antibacterial compounds. The story gets even more interesting when we look at here we see growth of Flavobacterium by itself. Then in red, we see Flavobacterium plus the Pseudomonas, and you can see populations drop off rapidly because of the production of Coriancin. But much to our surprise, when we add Bacillus cereus to that mixture of, Flavobacterium and Pseudomonas, we restore growth. So somehow Bacillus cereus was protecting Flavobacterium from Coriancin action. It turned out that Bacillus was suppressing Coriancin production in the Pseudomonas. We then began to look, well, are there any effects the other way? Do these organisms affect Bacillus? So this is what Bacillus looks like alone on petri plates initially. and 3 days after inoculation. This is what it looks like when you add flavobacterium to it. You start getting these kind of dendrites growing out, these almost tendrils growing out from the colonies. And when you do that the same with Bacillus plus P. coriensis, you can see here, if you can pick up the detail, you get this mat of dendrites growing out from the Bacillus colony. So we don't know the basis for that. We're looking at that now. But we know that both of these organisms will change the nature of Bacillus cereus growth. We then found what we considered to be the pinnacle of community ecology. And that's a phenotype or characteristic that you only see with the entire community. You can't see with any of the individuals or pairs. Something you wouldn't predict from the individuals or pairs, or a so-called emergent property. And that turned out to be super biofilm production. So Bacillus and flavobacterium don't form biofilms, but Pseudomonas can. And when you add either Bacillus or flavobacterium to Pseudomonas, you don't see very much change in the biofilm. But when you add all three, this is a biofilm here, you double the amount of biofilm produced. So the blue here is the Pseudomonas. You can see it's the most abundant member. And what I find fascinating about this is you have almost catalytic amounts of flavobacterium, which is in pink, and Bacillus, which is in green. They're very tiny amounts, about 10% or less of the population. And yet, when they're together with Pseudomonas, they have this enormous effect on biofilm production. So we think this might make, as Thor, a good model community. So the reasons are, first, it's simple. So it has three members. We have full genome sequences of all three members. We can do genetic analysis, biochemical analysis, and have done many of those things in these organisms together and separately. And then we have evidence that they actually have a real-life interaction. So we have, first of all, two of them are hitchhikers on the third. We know that Bacillus feeds flavobacterium with peptidoglycan. We know that flavobacterium, I didn't mention this before, has this amazing ability to induce coriensin production, kind of dumb on flavobacterium's part, because then coriensin goes ahead and kills it. But we also know that Bacillus will protect flavobacterium by suppressing coriensin production. So there are all these interactions in various ways, and then there are these remarkable structures, the zorbs, that seem to be co-zorbs or multi-species zorbs. When you put Bacillus and flavobacterium together, they have this very repeatable behavior that, again, we don't know the ecological importance of, but we know it happens repeatedly. And then finally, the only phenotype that is absolutely dependent on all three is this augmented or super biofilm. So we think that there's good reason to believe that these organisms did, in fact, co-evolve together. They certainly co-localized together on roots. And we think this is the basis for a really tremendous genetic analysis. We've begun a genetic analysis of all three members to see what makes the community phenotypes. And very excitingly, one of the first sets of genes we found was an operon that doesn't have similarity to known genes. There are a couple of genes that have a little homology, but the whole operon doesn't look like anything else that we can find in bacteria. That's exactly what you'd predict, because if there are community-specific behaviors, no one's ever looked using genetic analysis for those behaviors. We've only looked at genetics of single organism or dual organism behaviors. And so you would predict that these community behaviors would fall into the genes that are of unknown function, and there are still many of those in bacteria. So we're really excited about pursuing those, figuring out what it is they do and how they affect the community. So some of the big questions we have are, what makes a community different from just an assemblage of microbes? And communities are what are tough to change, and communities are what we want to change, for example, in the soil. So how do we change them? What makes them genetically robust, resistant to change? And by the same token, what could we do to make them more vulnerable to change when we'd like to make a positive change for agriculture to affect soil and ultimately to affect the health of the planet with carbon storage and carbon fixation in soil. So that's, as I said, the beginning of the story. It took us 34 years to get to the beginning, but we finally have the makings, I think, of a model system that will enable us to understand microbial communities at unprecedented levels. And finally, I'd like to introduce you to the people who did this work. Greg Gilbert was the long-suffering graduate student accused of contamination. He's now chair of his department and a very successful professor at UC Santa Cruz, so I don't think I destroyed his career, but I was a little bit mean to him. Brooke Peterson was the intrepid graduate student who then took over the hitchhikers and said, okay, I'm going to turn this into real science and figure out what's going on. And then my more recent group of Gabrielle Lozano, Jen Heinrichs, Juan Bravo and Manuel Garavito all did the antibiotic characterization as well as the biofilm characterization of the community, which was also tremendously advanced by Amanda Hurley, who is also doing the genetics on flavobacterium. During my time at the White House, Eric Stab and Nicole Broderick were two former graduate students, now faculty elsewhere, who very generously came to Yale and each spent a year running my lab. I wouldn't have had a lab to go back to because the White House Ethics Office refused to let me have a relationship with my lab, so I had to have somebody else doing it, and I am forever indebted to Eric and Nicole for keeping my group going and giving us the base from which all the work I talked about today came from. Mark Martin is a colleague at University of Puget Sound who named the hitchhikers, and Jason Crawford is a chemist at Yale who's done all the chemistry on the small molecules. Dave Beebe is a professor in engineering, and his very, very creative postdoc, Chow Lee, is the one who discovered the Zorbs and also named them. I didn't know what a Zorb was before this. Look it up. It's pretty funny. And has taught me all sorts of metaphors for biology that biologists would never come up with, but engineers are really good at. So with that, I thank you for your attention, and I'll stop there.
We will now begin the question and answer session. Since this event is being recorded and live streamed, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking your question. We may also receive some questions from our online audience. And as an undergraduate institution, we reserve the first few questions for students. We will now take the first question.
My question is, you said that a couple of civilizations have been confirmed to have destroyed themselves as a result of destroying their soil, and that most likely our current civilization will follow the same path. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
So there's evidence that agricultural societies have largely, except in a few, like the Mayans, have lasted for about 250 years if they plow. So plowing will pretty much destroy the soil in about that amount of time. Kind of note where we are. We're kind of at that mark right now. And there is archaeological evidence that several of these societies have fallen. There is written reports of the loss of soil and the measurement of loss of soil. And we now have in modern times some excellent measurements of the loss of soil. So, for example, in the Midwest, between 1850 and now, we have lost half of our topsoil on average across the Midwest. So we know that it's going away. It's just going away a lot faster now, and that's why it's so urgent to act. So there's a great book called Dirt. So I spent 3 years in the White House trying to get President Obama to not use the word dirt. I'd say, Mr. President, we call it soil because we show respect. We should revere our soil. We shouldn't call it dirt. That's something that we don't like. So then he started calling it dirt just to tease me because that's the way he was. So then my last pack of – I give him books when he go on vacation to Martha's Vineyard. So my last batch of books, I couldn't resist. There's this great book, Dirt, and I gave it to him. I said, this doesn't give you license to call it dirt, but it's a great book. And if you're interested in the details on that, it's a brilliant discussion by David Montgomery from the University of Washington on the history of these civilizations and the evidence of how many civilizations have collapsed due to the erosion of soil. It's actually a pretty devastating read.
Hi. I was wondering what you think the role of ecological succession would play in soil degradation?
The role of ecological succession. Well, there's no question that soil degradation leads to a different community in the soil, and that it affects the animals, the plants, and the microbes. There's no question that the overall productivity of the soil radically changes and goes down. And one of the more frightening changes is that the production of methane can be significantly increased. So there are soil archaea that produce methane, and under degradation conditions, some of them are more likely to do that. And of course, methane is a very, very bad greenhouse gas, so that's a real threat. Is that kind of what you're getting at, or is there something else I'm missing?
I'm Bryant. Ooh. Hi, I'm Bryant. So given that antibiotic resistance is on the rise, would it be possible to treat people with bacteria that inhibit the production of toxins from other bacteria as opposed to giving them antibiotics, for example, like strep? Because I always get strep, and I'm like, gosh, probably shouldn't be taking antibiotics because it messes my tummy up, you know? So
yeah.
Do you know anything about that? Is there work with that? Or?
So there is some work. So a lot of bacteria have multiple ways of causing disease, multiple what we call virulence factors. And so often inhibiting one toxin won't be sufficient to prevent the disease. Often it's just the bacterial growth that causes the disease, like sepsis, is largely a reaction of our own immune system to the bacteria. They don't have to produce toxins at all for us to have that reaction. However, there are approaches to not just preventing the toxin production, but killing the bacteria through viruses that infect them. And I think that's one of the most exciting advances. People have been trying to use this now for almost a century. It started in Georgia, not Georgia the state, but Georgia near Russia. And they've been actually doing it in the former Soviet Union for many years now, and they know how to make it work. Only now, in the last about 5 years, has it started being really successful here, and I think it's going to be one of the big augmentations that we have to antibiotics. I don't think antibiotics are ever going to go away. I don't think we're ever going to not need them. But I think we're going to need ways to complement them so that we have less resistance developing. And I think phage or bacterial viruses are a big way to do that.
Hi. My question was, I know you touched a little bit about co-migration and its role in Thor, but could you just elaborate a little bit more on what co-migration is and the role that it plays within BC?
In the Zorbs?
In the Zorbs, yes. My bad.
I don't know the role. I wish I did. So the film I showed you is about 3 months old, and we've just been documenting the rate of movement of the Zorbs. And right now, in fact, Chao Li, who discovered this phenomenon, is looking at how you develop evidence, because he continually says he sees the bacillus drilling into the Zorb. And I'm not sure exactly how to show that. How do you prove that it's actually drilling into the Zorb? It gets in there. There's no question about it. But whether it's drilling, that's kind of an engineer's version of microbiology. So we're actually looking at that now. What bacillus gains, I don't know. We're hoping that some of our mutants of bacillus will be ineffective at co-sorbing, or whatever the word will turn out to be for making a multi-species zorb, and then we might begin to get at what's required for this process, but also what is bacillus gain. So I'm sorry, that one's so new that we are looking for lots of ideas. So if you have ideas, I'd love to hear them.
Hi, thank you so much for that interesting talk. So I'm an archaeologist. I'll just throw that out there. So while there's lots of examples of societies sort of not sustainably using their soils, there's also lots of indigenous and traditional societies that have tremendous soil conservation strategies. So when corn was domesticated, right, it was grown throughout the Americas with other plants that, even though it is a very destructive plant, right, beans and squash and other things were replacing those. So I actually was wondering if you know of anyone working on the microbiome communities of Amazonian dark earths, or the terra pretas in the Amazon basin. Some of the studies I saw from that, so those are these dark earths that seem to have soils that have developed because of like burning and lots of other activities by the native communities of the Amazon basin, that a lot of which are gone now, but a lot of like papaya plantations and things are on these soils, and they seem to kind of reproduce themselves even without the traditional activities that produce them. And I was just wondering, at least a little bit of what I was reading was trying to look at what enabled them to continue to produce, and I was just wondering if anyone was taking this approach that you seem to have developed here, to look at those soils in particular, because they might have that potential to like reproduce themselves if we can figure out what communities of microbes are creating them.
Yeah, absolutely. There are great studies going on. At this point, they're still at the descriptive level of saying who's there, which bacteria, and how do those communities differ from the Amazon before the slash and burn agriculture came in, or from northern, more temperate environment agriculture. And we just don't have answers yet. But yes, people are looking at that. And I think, again, it's going to be a very complex answer because the communities are so complex, but we now have the computational tools to make real comparisons between communities and ask how they're similar and how they're different. So, yeah, great question. And it's interesting that indigenous cultures that have lasted with an agricultural base for a long time do exactly what the three recommendations are: not to plow, to intercrop, and use cover crops. And in fact, if anybody heard the debate last week, I guess it was, Beto O'Rourke talked about using cover crops and no-till farming for protecting soils. The first time I ever heard soil brought up in a presidential debate.
We have time for two more questions.
Hi. So my question is, how will this research on the soil microbiome model complement other research on microbiome? Like, so I listened to your talk this morning, and so you were talking about the gut microbiome research to the response to antidepressant. And since, because the microbiome is so diverse, so how will this maybe soil model microbiome will complement other kind of research like that?
Great questions, both of them. So there are other groups looking at the gut microbiome in a model system, taking a few organisms from the gut microbiome, putting them together in vitro, and asking how they behave. That modeling is really interesting. I have reservations about it because bacteria are so small relative to the environment that we're looking at when we say gut microbiome, you know, it's on a macro scale, that there's no guarantee that 10 organisms you choose actually interact in that environment. So that's my one reservation, that are we really looking at organisms that form a community, or are they just part of a loose assemblage that happens to show up in roughly the same habitat? So I think the jury's out on that. What I think we'll test, and this is the second part of your question, how do we know whether what we learn in these simple systems is relevant to the real world or to other real worlds? So, for example, one of the questions we want to ask is, when we have some principles laid out and we have models of this soil microbiome, does that, in fact, reflect behavior of a gut microbiome? Are there general principles that we can begin to develop across all microbiomes? And that will come out of the mathematical models, in my opinion. That's where we will be able to mathematically predict a behavior, take input information and say, given this, what happens? We build the model, then we take it to another environment, put the same input in, and see if we can make valid predictions. And if we can begin to transfer predictions from one system to another, then I think we begin to turn microbial ecology into a more prediction-based science. One more.
My name is Ben Edwards. I'm a neuroscientist. So I'm interested in the inorganic part of soils as well. And so to kind of tie in this last discovery you've made with the biofilms and how they can allow things to move a lot faster, I was thinking about in the soil at a large scale, would these biofilms probably only be forming in the root systems and the rhizosphere, or can they actually, you think these films could allow bacteria to travel across some of the inorganic parts of the soil, mineral grains and things like that to widen their distribution?
That's one of my favorite topics because I've long had an obsession with sand. If anyone's interested in sand, it is another threatened resource that's part of soil, but it's also threatened in its own right. There's a great book on that called The World in a Grain. And it turns out that Bacillus cereus changes its behavior, Flavobacterium and Pseudomonas together change its behavior on sand. Just pure, sterile sand. And sand is so inert. I mean, there may be broken pieces of the crystal that, you know, have charges or something, but it's pretty inert. So what is Bacillus seeing that suddenly makes it sensitive? It actually dies off when it's on sand with some of the other organisms, which might be a clue to why in some fields Bacillus just doesn't work as a disease suppressive agent. It might be one of our first hints at why it's different to go into the field environment than the lab, because we didn't have sand in the lab. So that's one of the first things that we're actually working on is the inorganic component, particularly sand. And I don't have an answer yet, but we're hoping to study the biofilms on sand surfaces because we're actually building a new apparatus with our engineering friends so that we can let roots develop in sand and add the bacteria, and then do microscopy from underneath and see what's happening in terms of a biofilm. And we have all these bacteria fluorescently labeled, so that's feasible. So I'll come back in a year and tell you. I'd love to know the answer to that. But yes, the surface interactions are, of course, one of the big things in soil because minerals are a gigantic component.
This concludes tonight's program. Please join me in thanking Joe Handelsman.